And welcome to episode 20 of the Broker Collective podcast, coming to you at the end of a very, very eventful week in the mortgage, or in any freaking market, to be quite honest, off the back of Rachel Reeves' first budget as Chancellor. We are going to delve into the budget and what the implications are and what we think the outlook is going to be. Joining me today, as always, are my co-hosts, Lewis Trawlerman-Shaw.
Good afternoon. How are we?
And Jamie Damora-Lennox.
Yo, yo, yo. Hello.
Yo, 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 yo. Let's kick off with the budget. Rachel Reeves delivered her first budget, as I said, and it hasn't been received very positively. Lewis, I'm going to kick off with you today. Talk to me about the budget. Talk to me.
Talk to you about the budget. I don't mind it. I know there's a lot of people up in arms about it, but I don't mind it.
The sake of the podcast, though, can you please highlight your affiliations before you continue with your admiration of Rachel's budget?
Yeah, sure. So I voted Labour in the last general election. And you both know that I was very much a case of I didn't want to vote for Conservatives. I didn't want to vote for Reform. If you remember rightly, I said I wasn't particularly keen on voting Labour, but it was the kind of the least worst thing to do. That's what I thought.
You're a green man, aren't you?
Or a Lib Dem? At heart, I suppose, yeah. Part of me is, yeah. I guess probably closer to Lib Dem these days, but this would be a pointless wasted vote, which is one of the problems with our electoral system. So, yes, I voted for Labour as the least worst option that I thought would be the case. So, in terms of the budget, I don't mind it. And the reason I don't mind, I know there's obviously a lot of people up in arms. That was going to be the case, I think, probably no matter what they did, in all honesty. And that would have been the case whether it had been a Tory government, a Reform government, whoever it might have been. One element of the press would have kicked off about it in some way, shape or form. But I don't mind it. I don't mind it. Obviously, there are some people that will lose out. There are some people that will benefit.
Do you mind it?
No. But I think we have to have a grown-up conversation here about the reality. You can't have if you need to put public services back on a sustainable footing, someone's got to pay for it. So then, how do you pay for it? So are there things that I would have liked to have seen that weren't in the budget? Yeah, for sure. Are there things that I think could have been done better? Yeah, of course. But overall, given the state of public services and the state of the finances, you know, no matter who was in, there'd have been tricky choices to make. And we've got to have a grown-up conversation about if you want public services, you've got to pay for them. And someone's got to pay for it. And if you don't want public services, then that's fine. But that's a different conversation. So
can we pull this back into the mortgage and the property world, please, in terms of the implication of the budget for the area that we spend quite a lot of our time in?
So with regards to stamp duty, it's being framed, of course, that they're increasing stamp duty, but not really. They're just not renewing the kind of discount, effectively. It's a bit like saying, if you went into a store to buy a loaf of bread and it was priced at a pound, and then the shop decided to have a 20% discount and you could go and get it for 80p, you wouldn't go, oh, they put the prices up. You'd say the discount stopped, wouldn't you? Because it was always a pound. There was a discount to get it to 80p, and now that discount is finished. That's the same as stamp duty. It was always due. The previous Conservative government set it to revert back to normal. That was under their watch. So, I mean, they could have changed it permanently, couldn't they? They could have changed it permanently. They chose not to. So in that respect, it's not that they're hiking stamp duty. It's just that the discount is coming to an end. Is that a good thing? No, I would rather see stamp duty scrapped personally, and I would rather see, you know, some form of property value tax. We've been through this many times. We didn't get that. It's probably a good idea we didn't, because that would have really put the cat amongst the pigeons. So yeah, not great, but you know, again, if we want hospitals, if people want healthcare, we've got to pay for it somehow, and therefore taxes have had to rise. So, you know, what are you going to do about that? Someone's got to pay for it. That someone is everyone else, all of us. Will Jamie, it impact the property market? Yeah, probably. Will it be negative? We'll wait and see.
Jamie.
I just didn't think we're so close to the end of rates and pain. We're literally, that finish line was in sight. I can see it. I can smell it. The cheers were there. And then it was, why rock the boat? Why rock the boat? Like, you know, you've got 5 years, you've got plenty of these budgets. You can do what you really want to do with, but just get us across the line first before reinventing the wheel. So I think, you know, I get it. They're trying to do the pain early days, and then they got time to, you know, they'll be hated. There's time, trying time to win back voters for the next election on there as well. I get it. But from the financial side, there is risk at the moment in time, I think, on rates. There's a lot of pressure on lenders if they can hold. I think there's only going to be lenders that are holding, that are chasing lending volume for the end of the year. If that wasn't there and we're at the start of the year, I think we'd have seen a lot of lenders spike already. Overall for the property market, stamp duty is not great. Right to buy, that obviously the discount's been reduced on there. Actually, quite substantial discounts being reduced from it as well. It's not actually that big a discount you can get on it anymore, which is probably the right thing to do because they're not building more council homes. But then it's going to stop them people getting on the housing ladder potentially, or maybe less inclined to do it. The promise on homes, we haven't hit that target for, you know, been nowhere near the 300k homes. I think 260,000 is the best we've ever done, and that was in a Tory government. No digs there. So I just think realistically, the 300 is going to be, you know, it's going to be a promise. It's going to be missed. It's the same old over again. We all know that the housing market can't be fixed in 5, 10, 15 years as a long-term growth plan. Everyone needs to be on the same page. But yeah, it's not looking great for rates, I don't think. And we could be in for a bumpy ride in the next few months and run up to Christmas, unless positive stuff comes out from the Bank of England.
So we have seen some volatility in the markets as a result of the budget, especially with regards to gilts. And a few of the more specialist lenders have been withdrawing from the market as a result of this. Some of the mainstream lenders, though, have come out with repricing downwards, some of them upwards. There's a little bit of a wobble. We have all been concerned about the spike in the gilts market and the potential implications for that, but that seems to be somewhat calming down now. So the main concern was that we have a reaction similar to the one that we did following Quasi's budget in 2022. Now, we all knew that that wasn't going to happen because the backdrop was somewhat different now, but there has been that spike, there has been that volatility. I do think that that will calm down. With regards to the budget, the one thing that's hit hardest in terms of my pipeline at the moment is with regards to the additional stamp duty and the hike up there. I've got one deal at the moment where the client's going to have to find an extra 15,000 on a few other deals as having to be a revision there. Deals will still get done if people are still motivated. I think they'll still go ahead with doing what they're doing. It might lead to a revision. I've been speaking to a few solicitors recently, and they've been telling me how they've been massively under the cosh to get deals over the line in time for the changes to come in, because in some cases that they'll make a monumental impact. There is no stimulation in this budget for the property market. I don't really think they care about the property market, to be quite honest. There's nothing major to help people onto the ladder. I think with the implications that it's going to have on businesses as well, especially with the increase in NI, I think that potentially people are going to think very hard about recruiting newer people onto their team, especially if they are near or nearabouts the minimum wage level. How do you guys, actually, let me put this back to you guys, that what impact do you think the NI will have on the economy and also the growth in the economy and us actually pushing past the pain that we're in at the moment?
Go on, Jamie.
Okay, I'll go. Any tax, I think a lot of businesses have been under a lot of pressure over the last few years. There's, you know, nothing's really got up and running, them gears moving post-COVID. It's been especially in our industry, it's been a bit of survival mode, treading water. Can we get out the other side of it as well? And you only have to look down the high street, number of retail units that are coming available. So, you're shifting minimum wage up, so they've got to pay staff more. You've got the national insurance contribution having to go up for employers. So again, more costs for them as well. So they're treading water at the moment in time, and this is an extra weight around their ankle trying to drag them back down. So I don't think it's great in that sense. I'm pro-business, anything you can incentivize. And I think recruitment, there's going to be businesses that are going to think, can I, especially with AI actually as well, if you've got a very mundane minimum wage job on there as well, can you get AI to do that for you and replace a person? Because that's going to be the next thing is, actually, can I cut this person out of the equation altogether? And there'll be industries where actually they'll be thinking, do I really need to stomach this cost of a person? Or can I actually set up some AI model to replace them as well? So it's not great for that. I think it's atrocious for the next generation as well. We all want to be paid more. I completely get that. But an 18-year-old to 18 to 20-year-old at £10 per hour seems absolutely madness with no experience, day one rights on there as well. There's going to be a lot of businesses out there just go, I'm not prepared to take that punt. And that's the reality of the world, unfortunately. And I think it's going to be harder for the younger generation to get jobs. So it's going to be tricky.
I think my first wage at 17, when I worked at a bank's call centre, was I think around £4.80, maybe, actually £5 an hour or something like that.
Yeah, it's mad. And it's only really accelerated in the last few years. So it's the other issue we've got is there'll be people that have, been earning 14, 13, 14, 15 pounds per hour, where they're potentially in some semi-skilled roles. And we're now getting this minimum wage move up. And the next lot of people aren't probably going to see the wage increases in the next few years. You're just going to see the lower earners see their income and they all get merged into one as well. So the low-skilled jobs are going to be merging with semi-skilled jobs in the long run. So yeah, literally, I think, the middle ground's going to end up poorer overall.
If employers' costs are going up, Lewis, and they're subsequently having to pay their staff more through increased national insurance contributions, it's a greater cost to the business. Do you not think that that's just going to result in them passing the increased costs on to the end consumer, which one could argue could be inflationary? And considering that our main aim, or one of our main aims, has been getting inflation down from double digits to where we are, do you think that could hamper future base rate increase prospects?
Possibly, yes, possibly. However, it's time to get a bit of nuance in here. So in terms of businesses that will pay more NICs, so it affects businesses with, I believe it's 11 employees or more, isn't it? It's not, so if you've got, is it 10 employees or fewer, you're actually going to be net potentially no worse off and possibly a little bit better off, if I've understood it correctly. I believe that's the case, isn't it?
So I'm talking about larger employers here, Lewis.
Yeah. So, yeah, but what I'm going to say here is, so in terms of the number of businesses that have 1 to 9 employees, according to the FSB anyway, there's almost 1.2 million that fall into that category of 1 to 9. So that's 1.2 million businesses that will see a benefit. And there's approximately about 240,000 that may have to pay more. But the ones that have to pay more will be bigger businesses, of course. Now, may they pass that on in terms of higher costs to consumers? Maybe. But then if they become uncompetitive, then they won't be able to do that. Now, what's the difference between, people are saying this is kind of bad for business. And I'm not suggesting it's great, because if you've got 50 employees and all of a sudden you've got to stump up X amount of thousands of pounds more in NICs, then yeah, of course, that's going to hit your bottom line for sure. Of course it is. What was the alternative? I think this is the important piece. What's the alternative? Because you're either going to put it on people, you know, in the form of employee NI, or you had to put it on income tax or VAT. They had to pick it up somewhere. So in a sense, it's kind of the least worst option, isn't it? It's not good, but what was the alternative? You know, let's not forget how we got here. This is important, I think. Let's not forget how we got here. The previous government cut NICs without, well, basically knowing that they weren't going to win the next election, and without a way of actually funding that. So, do you know what I mean? I don't get. It's got to come from somewhere. Where do you want to put it?
Lewis, as I've been saying to you before, if I had any confidence whatsoever in this government actually taking the money and actually spending it in the way that they're saying they're going to spend it, and I can see it, and I can feel it, and I can benefit from it, I don't think people would be too taken back on it. But as far as I'm concerned, this, like everything else, is just going to be pissed away, and we're not going to see the end goal of it. But as they say, just because your last girlfriend left you doesn't mean that the current one will. So we have to give the Labour government the, how can I say this? We have to give them the opportunity to prove themselves. But unfortunately, there is nothing that I've seen so far that has given me any confidence that they are equipped to manage the economy. I'm very sorry, Lewis, but I'm just not impressed at the moment. Jamie, we're coming across very quickly also to the US election next week, where the Americans will decide if they want to go down the Trump path or if they want to go down the Harris path. What impact do you think, if any, that's going to have on what we see here in terms of our markets, our mortgage pricing? What implications do you think that could have, Jamie?
I think, you know, we've learned very much so, and I think Lewis used to reference quite a lot is, you know, they sneeze, we catch a cold. So I think this, you know, whatever happens over there, it's generally going to filter over here somewhat on there as well. So we could be in the same scenario. You get the results of the election, markets don't react well, could put pressure on over here as well. So it's a test in time for the end of the year, heading into, you know, the end of Q4.
When are things going to go back to freaking, not normality, because what is normality, but come on, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know that we run businesses and I know we should be resilient and we've got to take the knockdowns and it's part of business. I get that. I've been in business for 10 years and God has it taken out of me. But if every time we're getting this, when is someone just going to help us? When are we going to get that nice deep tissue massage and someone to say it's going to be okay?
I don't think that's coming. I don't think that's coming. I think this is just the scope of things from here on in, because this isn't a UK-centric problem, is it? This is across all advanced economies in the world. All advanced economies in the world have got, you know, really, really high tax rates at the moment. And they're all struggling with the same problem. An aging workforce, a longer, you know, an aging workforce, people living longer, needing more complex healthcare, all these kind of unfunded pension liabilities. This is not just a UK issue. This is across the entire developed, well, advanced economies. This is not, and this is the bit where it's in terms of, we just have to have an honest conversation about it, because it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse, because these old people keep living longer. You know, this isn't going to go away anytime soon. So I think in that respect, there's no point hoping for it to be better. It's just kind of suck it up and deal with what you've got and accept it. That's all you can do, really. You know, I mean, it would be nice, wouldn't it? In kind of, in a fairy tale world, we'd have you know, massive economic growth and all the rest of it, and blah, blah, blah. But when you are an advanced economy, it's, obviously it's much more difficult to do that, isn't it? Like, it's a bit like when you go to the gym. When you've not been to the gym for, you know, whatever, or for 5 years or whatever, you put on muscle and lose weight pretty quickly. But as you advance through that and you become, you know, a lot fitter and all the rest of it, you know, your strength gains, your muscle gains, all the rest of it peter off because there's less scope for you to go. So, you know, the idea of kind of getting 4 and 5 or 6% GDP growth, I think, is for the birds. That's not the world that we live in anymore, I don't think, unless AI completely revolutionizes everything, which is possible, I guess. But we're not having enough kids. So, you know, all these things, I mean, a lot of it stems from the housing market, doesn't it? I mean, there are obviously a lot of landlords will be probably stinging over the introduction of a higher rate of stamp duty. But let's not forget that how have we got to this position where fewer people own the home, fewer people are having kids? Why? Well, they can't buy a house, and therefore they don't feel stable enough to start a family. So all of this comes back to housing. You fix housing and you fix an awful lot of stuff. So, you know, we've got to do something to do that, because if, you know, I mean, we've got a generational time bomb waiting to happen, haven't we? When the next generation, so the people above us, start to kind of move into retirement, and there's a lot of them, and the birth rate as it is where it is, we're heading for a reckoning. We're heading for a reckoning in about 20, 25 years, and no one's got an answer to that at the minute. So I don't think it's going to get any better. It's not very nice to say, is it, or think about. I mean, I try not to. That's why I drink so heavily, but that's the reality.
Enjoy that 1p off the pint.
Exactly.
What was that all about? What a palaver.
To be honest, I think the 1p off the pint thing, I think that's just a bit of a knock. It really, that actually annoyed me, because it's so little. No one cares about a penny on a pint of beer. It's just not necessary, is it?
No.
They should have just kept that money and bought a few more ambulances or something. I'm pretty certain everyone would have been happier with that.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next topic that I want to discuss today, and that is the state of the buy-to-let market. And that feeds in very nicely to me about prospects for first-time buyers, because let's look at this. I am not calling the death of the buy, or I am a little bit. I am thinking that for people who want to buy a buy-to-let property, especially down here in London and South East, by the time you factor the extra stamp duty, tax positions, et cetera, yes, you're banking on long-term capital appreciation. Yields are going to get swallowed up by all the other costs and everything. I'm not sure that's the way forward. And considering that pre-COVID, a large part of my business was buy-to-let and new buy-to-let purchases from existing landlords, refinancing, pulling money out to do their next deals, that movement and the propensity to grow the portfolio for the people that I've got generally hasn't been there as it was previously. So let's look at the private rental sector. Now, a lot of landlords have had hikes in their mortgage cost of financing, especially over the last 2 years. And a lot of them reluctantly have passed them off to their tenants. Those tenants who are having to fork out more for their living costs, for their rent, which is going to form a large proportion of their income, are tomorrow's first-time buyers. How the F are these younger kids, this next generation, going to get onto the property ladder without either taking substantial levels of debt at high loan-to-value or with the assistance of the bank of mum and dad? We are already seeing the average age of first-time buyers increasing. It is not uncommon to have first-time buyers in the late 30s, even going into their 40s. Is the ability to own your own property a fundamental right of being British? Jamie.
As a country, we are obsessed with owning property. If you look around the rest of Europe, the actual proportion of people that own versus rent is completely opposite to over here. It's a UK thing where we do want to own. And ultimately, there is a right that you should be able to own your own plot of land with your own dwelling on there and the security and warmth for your family to provide from it all. But we can only work with the hand we're dealt. And we're in this, you know, the hand's been dealt. And there's probably not, there's no really going back from it, really. We're not going to ever, but you know, with the government, whatever government's in, we're not going to build enough homes. They're not going to build enough social housing. And you do need landlords. You know, you can hate landlords all you want, but unless the government's going to pick the tab up of, let's going to build loads of social housing, you still need properties to rent. Because there's going to be people regardless that either don't want to own because they still exist, or people that can't own because they can't save on there as well. So I think you're going to need, you need everything working in unison, but it's only going to get hard for first-time buyers. We know that house prices can keep going up. It's going to get harder for tenants because if you do get people exiting the market, yes, it may be going into first-time buyers, and there's some first-time buyers that are going to, but you look at some of these new build sites that are just being bought up in mass by huge investment firms and hedge funds. You know, you've got Lloyds Banking Group wanting to be one of the biggest landlords in the UK. You've got Blackstone, you know, again, buying up huge amount of new build properties from some developers. BlackRock probably over here as well. So there's, you know, money's flowing, but it's where is it flowing to and who's going to benefit from it as well. So and I know a lot of people want the death of your private landlord, but sometimes, you know, sometimes it's better than what it could be at the end of the day as well. I'm a firm believer of, and unless the government's going to do something with more affordable housing and social housing in the future, I think you're going to need them at the end of the day.
Lewis?
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, so I'm just Googling. So the average age of a first-time buyer in 2006 was 29. And that's now at 33. That's a pretty significant jump. It's even worse if you look at London. So the average age in 2005 in London was 32. It's now 35. So... yeah, we've got a problem. We've got a problem, but this has been stored up for generations, hasn't it? This has been stored up for generations, not just the previous Conservative Party, but the Labour government before that and the Conservative Party before that. This has been in the making for 40-odd years.
It might have been in the making of the 40-odd years, but I'm not seeing any way out of it within any credible time period, Lewis.
No, there isn't. No, there isn't.
Who do we blame?
Well, I mean, you can blame an entire economic model if you want, which is broadly speaking what I think. If you look at kind of the net wealth of advanced economies over the past, say, 50 years, all of them have gone from owning large swathes of their own country into including, you know, trains and hospitals and schools and all that kind of stuff. They've all gone from owning tons of their own wealth and parts of their own country to virtually nothing. The outlier is China, but even they've seen it come down. So in the countries where you see that happen the most, you've also seen inequality rise the highest. So that tells you that necessarily that selling off all your assets isn't probably a good idea. Well, it's a good idea for a few people that sat at the top creaming it all off, but it's not a good idea for most of us. So if you want to blame someone, you blame an entire economic model that would kind of started in the 70s and into the 80s, I suppose, really. But no, there's not a credible way out of this. There isn't. I've made no bones about that. I think we're absolutely knackered. You know, unless you fix the foundational problems, which is fundamentally, you've got to tax the right people. You've got to tax the right people. And that was one of the missed opportunities, I think, in this budget. You know, you've got that lobby group, Patriotic Millionaires, who are saying, basically, tax us more, and this will help fix things. And yet, every single... I mean, And this is not a few people. We're talking about a lot of wealthier people. Even Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, keeps saying, you should tax me more. You should tax my wealth. And every single governmental administration across the world just ignores them. Why? When they're saying, tax me more, I've got tons of cash. You can have some of it. Just tax me. But they're not going to give it up. Who would? But when you've got lobby groups going, you should tax us, why aren't governments listening to them?
Lewis, do you give it up?
Yeah, I'll give it up, mate. If I may, but this is the thing, isn't it? In terms of when we're talking about maybe a wealth tax over and above assets of 10 million. So the first 10 million you don't get taxed on, and then above, you know, you maybe pay a 1 or 2% tax on assets above 10 million pounds, for example. That doesn't seem an awful big issue when you consider that you're probably making at least a 5 to 6 to 7% return on your assets each year. If you had to pay 1% away, so let's say I've got 50 million quid and I have to pay 1% on 40 million quid, but I've made 5% in that year. So effectively, I've only made 4%. That doesn't seem a massive trade-off, if I'm honest. That's the only way we fix it. But no one's willing to do that. So where do you go?
This is a deep thought.
I went to a training conference, not training, on the day of the budget. My network had an event in London, and we went and we heard some really good speakers and everything. It was all about resilience and how to build your business. And I really needed it at that moment in time. And it really picks yourself up in terms of doing so. My heart goes out to all those people who are really struggling still at the moment, with the cost of living crisis, with increased mortgage costs, those who've got childcare costs and everything like that. I just feel that there's a lot of weight on a lot of people. And yes, there's all about resilience, and I agree with that. And every time you get knocked down, you've got to get up and you've got to dust yourself off. But there's only a certain amount of that people can do before it starts chipping away at you. And then it takes you a little bit longer to get up, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this feeds into another topic that we always talk about, is with regards to the protection and the needs of people to have things in place. I know that mental health is one of the areas that I think a lot of people have been needing help with at the moment, especially from providers who give them that assistance. I'm just worried about this country still. It's like, just like Jamie said, it's like, when is it going to give up? When is the pressure going to be taken off people's backs? When are the good times coming, guys? Come on, when are the good times coming?
When would you rejoin the single market?
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, he loves it. He loves the single market.
Those listening, and actually, Jamie, what is your position on the European Union and Brexit? Do you think it is a good move or a bad move?
I've got no views either way, to be fair. I didn't vote in either, and it had no bother to me. I'm not a fan of, not a fan with. Makes zero difference to me overall. So,
but Lewis, I know you're very opinionated with regards to our removal from the European Union and the economic harm that's had. And to a lot of extent, I would actually agree with you. But then the Eurozone isn't in a massively better situation that we're at the moment, are they?
No, they're not. No, they're not. But that doesn't mean that we wouldn't benefit from it. So, you know, just because maybe Germany's struggling and maybe France is struggling, that doesn't mean that wouldn't, it would still be beneficial for us to have fewer trade barriers and fewer and less red tape, less bureaucracy. You know, I mean, Goldman Sachs reckons it's not 4 to 5% off GDP. I saw a report the other day that's basically saying it's costing us about 40 billion quid a year. So just through that one simple excision of rejoining the single market and the customs union, you remove the black hole. It's gone. It vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems odd that knowing that would basically fix a lot of the economic problems we've got, it seems odd to not have done that, given that would be the least harmful for everyone.
But realistically, Lewis, I can't see it happening. Not by this government in any way, shape or form. So
maybe not.
This is what it is.
Maybe not. But it does seem odd that, again, it's this whole thing of, you know, oh, we're paying more tax. Well, the country voted to remove itself from the biggest trading market, the biggest free trade area on the planet, and we were told there were going to be consequences, and that's going to mean a shrinkage of trade with the EU. It's going to be an added cost to businesses, and that would have a negative impact on the public finances. We were told that was what's going to happen. That has happened. There's now plenty of evidence to show that that's happened and the impact it's had. And we know that we could effectively just rejoin the Single Market and Customs Union. We don't need to take up the political affiliation. We could just go back as EFTA, couldn't we? We just go back as EFTA. We don't have to subscribe to the political side. And then, broadly speaking, you fix the problems that we have. It just seems daft not to do it. You know?
And those are Lewis's thoughts on the European Union.
Well, it's like now, this. I'm not being funny, Riz, but if you go to the doctor, if you went to a doctor's and they said, go to the doctor and they said, well, what we can do is we can operate and that's definitely going to make you better, or we could just give you some tablets and it won't make you better. You'd say, well, operate. We'll do that then, wouldn't you? We know that going back would make us better. So let's just do that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay. Now, let's move on. With regards to today's date, we are recording this on the 1st of November. Now, considering that we are now going to be in the run-up towards the festive period, and we all know what happens around the early to middle part of December, people stop working in our industry, and it slows down considerably. So now is a good time to start thinking not only about what you're going to do for the last, let's say, 6 weeks of this year, but also about planning for 2025. Very soon we will be ringing the bell on the new year, and I wanted to take this opportunity to ask both of you about what your plans are for you and your business for 2025. Has the budget affected or had any implications on the plans that you were going to make? Are you still confident that the market is going to grow? Are you looking to increase your team? What are your plans for 2025? And Jamie, I'm going to come to you.
Cheers. So my outlook probably on the market has shifted post-budget. I think a lot was my expectations for the housing market is probably based on HSBC and other likes of them who are predicting probably lower than what some other people have predicted where the base rate would go on there as well. And it would bring back that feel-good factor back to the mortgage space, more people demand, more property moving. It looked quite rosy and quite promising based on a month ago and where rates were heading. Post-budget, jury's out for next year for me. So we're now up to me and two other advisors, admin. I'm probably going to ride that out at that point for the next 6+ months still, just see how things shape, how it moves. And then just reassess at the end of the day. I normally like to be proactive and put a plan for next year, but the goalposts change so much now. It's practically impossible to try and know exactly where you are. We're now in a space where if it does take off, we've probably got the staff to cope with it. We know it's probably going to be a bit quieter heading into the close of the year. So we are geared up if there was a bit of an uptake on there. So that's all good. We've also got Meg coming back from mat leave. So we're in a good space staffing. But do I think next year is going to set the world alight other than remortgages? Probably not at the way things are at the moment in time. You've got to think first time buyers are going to have to save more up in stamp duty. Movers are going to need more money for moving costs. Buy to let. I don't really touch an awful lot of it, and the ones there are pretty much dead. So yeah, I think it's going to be a challenging purchase market. Remortgage is there. You know, I've got a good book up for renewal next year, but new stuff is going to be, which is the more exciting stuff at the end of the day, financially for a business, is probably going to still be slimmer pickings, I think. I saw some data out from one of the sourcing platforms saying already this month, inquiries or mortgage searches down 15-20% this month. So we're back to the kind of the July time. So we're going to see definitely a slowdown this the end of this year. I think the only thing that will see us through to the end of this year is all them people that are due around February, March, April next year with this budget that I think before, prior to the budget, thinking, I'm going to wait because I'm pretty certain rates are going to keep coming down. So I don't need to do anything now. This may kick them into gear. So we could still have a strong end of the year. But then if we shift back round again and market looks a bit more rosy, gilts settle down on there as well, we're going to end up with some lull at some point because, you know, we're contacting every client at 6 months at the moment in time and securing deals then. But in a normal market, you'd probably do that 3-4 months before then as well. So I think when it does properly calm down, you're going to have a couple of months on that remortgage business where people aren't proactive and trying to get stuff done as well. So there's definitely going to be a lull at some point. It will bring some business in now, but I think Jan, Feb could be a tricky couple of months, I think.
Lewis?
Yeah, so I think in terms of positioning this, I mean, we've got to make sure that, and I think this goes for every single broker out there, I think we've got to make sure that first-time buyers are aware of the stamp duty implications that are coming on the 31st of March next year.
How are you going to make them aware, Lewis?
Social media. Get the carousels out for the boys, do some videos. But I think that's important. I mean, you know, because every time there's a stamp duty cliff edge, whether it's this, whether it was in COVID, whether it was in 2016 when they introduced the 3% surcharge on buy-to-let, every time there's a cliff edge, it goes to absolute excrement, doesn't it? Let's be honest, it goes to the rats. So we've got to make sure that we're talking to first-time buyers, and that if they are preparing to buy, make them aware that actually, you know, there's going to be a huge load on conveyancing. There's going to be a massive load on conveyancing. That might be kind of, there may be a little bit less pressure because presumably with the 5% surcharge on additional properties, that will take some buy-to-let purchases out of the market for sure. It's bound to. But I think we need to make them aware that if they want to complete and not face that stamp duty deadline of basically the 1st of April,
mm-hmm.
They don't actually have that long because there'll be a mad rush into the market. We know exactly how this playbook turns out. You know, everyone rushes in at the last moment thinking they're going to be able to beat the deadline. They can't beat the deadline, then they pull out. There's chains falling left, right, and center. So, you know, if you're a first-time buyer, I'm going to be saying to first-time buyers, look, get your skates on, because December will whip by in the blink of an eye, because it always does. And then once you're into January, you basically forget it if you want to complete by March. So this month, realistically, if you're a first-time buyer, this is the month to be buying and getting all your ducks in a row, and you know, to give yourself a chance. I mean, it goes for sellers as well, I suppose. So basically, if you're planning on buying or moving, we need to tell people that they really do need to get a move on to stand the chance of getting in inside the deadline. And there's going to be a lot of disappointed people. We know that. I mean, I can remember I was working in London at the time when they introduced the...
You worked in London?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
What
was that?
I've not been very far in my life. You know, I get a nosebleed if I go further than the local shop. But when I worked in London in 2016, it was an absolute car crash with trying to get people completed by, you know, for the 3% surcharge. It was an absolute car crash. And you know, I've just got visions of that happening again. So we've got to do something. We've got to tell people about it.
We need to, the brokers need to unite, and we need to go on a information campaign of reminding first-time buyers about the stamp duty changes.
For sure, for sure. So I think we might see, you know, now that that's confirmed, now that it is confirmed that stamp duty is reverting back to what it was previously, maybe we'll see a raft of first-time buyers coming out of the woodwork to buy. Maybe that's what we'll see. I mean, every time there's been a stamp duty cliff edge, well, at least in recent memory, so the COVID, and the one in 2016, we saw an acceleration of house prices into that cliff edge, if you remember. In 2016, it was about 8%, 9% in London. In COVID, it was obviously massive in COVID, wasn't it? We saw a big acceleration of house prices then. Maybe we'll, you know, will we see that again? I don't know. I hope we don't, because it's going to make all of us poorer in the long run. But so I think there are things here where you can take that kind of experience now and say, look, this is what happens when there's a cliff edge for stamp duty. Just be aware of it.
It's going to be a very interesting time, that's for sure. Okay, we're going to end this week's podcast with Technology Corner. And as Jamie usually takes it, the baton is being handed on to Lewis Trawlman Shaw to talk about his experience of, is it Mortgage Quote, Lewis?
Yes.
Okay. And also, I would like to hint that this is by no means an endorsement by the Broker Collective of this particular product. This is just Lewis's personal experience of it. Lewis, unless they want to sponsor us. Lewis, take it away and give us the sure. lowdown.
So mortgagequote.me is a plugin that you can add to your website where customers can go onto the website and then generate a mortgage quote. Now, I don't like using the word quote, but we'll have to go with it for this. But it also comes with some calculators, such as stamp duty, overpayment calculators, repayment calculators, etc. But the main thing there is it's to be used as a lead gen tool so that people can pop the details in, look at what rates they may be eligible for, and it will search kind of through, you know, whether you're a first-time buyer, whether you're moving home, buy-to-let. You know, it also encompasses some elements of adverse credit. So if people have got adverse credit, they can input some of that information. And it allows people to see what they potentially could be looking at. And from what I can gather, the data is reasonably accurate. Jamie has got it embedded on his website. I've not as of yet, because I've got a new website in the pipeline. but Jamie, how have you found it in terms of, you know, have you had any positive impact other than me just asking for mortgages?
Literally, I'm inundated with quotes from you, mate. I've got about 5 mortgages on the go for you now. No, so I think what I really like about it, and I've tested it a lot myself just to make sure the accuracy's there, and it has been pretty spot on, to be fair. There's odd one or two things, but that's just fluctuation in the mortgage market, and then I spoke to them about it, and they've sorted it there and then. So it's been really proactive on that front. What I do like, though, is it's got like the chat function. So where you normally have like a live chat on a website, you can click that and it's going to have 3 options in there. You can WhatsApp the firm through that chat function. I think they're about to launch actual live chat through it as well. And you can do the quick quote through there as well, where it will ask some intuitive questions. It's like you're having a conversation with a chatbot, and it'll spurt out some figures on there as well. So I think for me in the long, you know, my main thing was testing it first of all, and eventually I'll put it probably on like a funnel, like a landing page, run some Google or Facebook ads on there as well, and just use it to pull client data in, and then, you know, hopefully funnel them through the process, and then hopefully get some leads off the back of it. But for the time being, it's just sitting there as a handy tool of people just researching and want some figures, but certainly going to be a lead gen tool heading into next year for me.
And have you had any kind of, has anyone interacted with it yet?
Yeah, I've had. Well, the only thing you got to be mindful of is you get some. No, I know your ones because you put your email address in. But few people have got smart and they've just like put a test@test.com email on there as well. And that's not people. It's not you. It's not Lou. You know, the only people I know that's got on there as well. So it certainly is put in. People are using it. There's been about three or four of them without even pushing it, and it's not everywhere on my site. I've only really put it in one or two places at the moment in time. So I think that, you know, if you kind of harness it, push it, lean on it a bit more and drive traffic to it, and the right type of people looking at it, it's going to certainly pull more stuff in there as well. And if nothing else, it's just an extra feature to add. It's just same with a lot of things. Having certain tools don't always necessarily mean tangible business, but if someone says you go on your website and they can see they can get that information from yourself, and you're transparent about what service you offer and what rates are available on there, and they can sense check what you're kind of coming up with as well, the integrity's there. So actually it may not directly give you leads, but inadvertently it may strengthen people to use you as well. So I think, you know, there's bigger things at play with it.
So sorry, is this giving an indication of the lenders on there then, or does it not do that? Sorry.
You can, yeah, at the end of it, it will spurt out a lender. So it does say this is indicative. Obviously, it's subject to criteria and affordability on there as well. But it will give you the option of the lender with the headline rate. It doesn't sort by true cost or anything. It's purely like you would go on a comparison site. And you can either choose to hide the lender's name or show the lender's name on there as well. You've got control of whether that information is available. That will then pull through into an email to yourself of this person's inquired on your website. So then you can obviously reach out, add on to mail marketing, whatever you want to do with them. And the client will also get a copy of the quote sent out to them via email as well. So got a record of that as well. So, and there's options like you can check the, you can find out more information about the deal, such as early repayment charges, arrangement fees, valuation fee through it. But there's also a bit of check eligibility. So the call to action's in there as well. And that will then stipulate that you are actively looking for that deal. Email gets fired across to you, so you can get straight in contact with that client as well. And it's instantaneous. So as soon as they inquire, it comes straight across to yourself.
Is there a way of ensuring that the contact details that get put in are legit, so you don't just get people using, like, you know, hello@mickeymouse.com, whatever it might be?
Far as I'm aware, no, it doesn't have that feature yet. So it literally sucks. So, I had one put in test@test.com as an email, and that literally still come through to me as well. So there is obviously ways of, I'm sure, you know, a bit of feedback with them. They'll probably look to implement some other bits on there as well. But yeah, we'll see.
Because this is one of the things I've looked at it, and I just thought, one of the things it really needs to do is, rather than display the deals, it needs to send them, it just needs to send it on email. So it's a case of, this is going to get delivered to your inbox, rather than display it there and then, to prevent the use of kind of phony emails and all the rest of it. Because, you know, I guess that's my concern. But it's got other features on there. It's got a lender carousel that you can implement. Some of the calculators are pretty good, I think. I do like the stamp duty calculator, and actually that would probably be quite good. That would probably be quite useful for people, especially now that we know that it is changing, so that people can go onto the website and check what their stamp duty liability may be. That's going to be important for people, certainly for the next few months. So I think it's a good little tool. I think
does it interact with CRM, your CRM?
You, at the moment in time, it looks like it only integrates with Zoho as a CRM provider, but I'm going to pop a message to see if we can do anything via Zapier or webhooks where I can pull it through to other bits on there as well. But at the moment in time, as soon as someone inquires, it pulls through into a Excel spreadsheet, which you could easily set it up that once you download that, you could import that information into your CRM within probably about two or three clicks. So it's not strenuous, but ultimately, you know me, if I can automate it, I'll make it happen. So we'll see if what can be done.
So that's mortgage-quote.me.
And my final question is, what about pricing then?
What is the pricing?
Isn't it 45? So for the top one, I think it's about 45 quid a month, I think, is it?
Let's have a look, because I signed up and I forgot what I signed up for. So let's have a look on mortgage quote.
There we go. They've got starter plans for free, and it goes all the way to $49.99 to an expert plan, excluding VAT. So they've got four different packages here based on different types of
features. I'm on the $34.99 at the moment in time, but once they've got that live chat up and running, I'll switch over to the expert at $49.99. It's what I'm personally going to do. It's what the live chat all built into it. So any touch point you can have with a customer, the better.
And, I mean, for the sake of 50 quid a month, I think it's 50 quid plus VAT, so it'd be...
Plus VAT, yeah.
So 60 quid a month, 720 quid a year. That's right, isn't it? 6 times 12. 720 quid a year. You only need one deal, one additional deal.
But this doesn't tell them that they're eligible, because as all of you know, headline rates aren't just what we're looking at in terms of sourcing. It's with regards to lenders, speed, service, underlying criteria, etc., etc. So how does that feed in?
So ultimately, that's when they reach out. So they want it. The button is, as soon as you look at the deal, the options are more details about the deal or check eligibility. And that's when it fires off an email to yourself. If someone clicks that, they want to check if they're eligible, you can get in contact with them and discuss it. But what it does open the door up to is, we know in our industry, there is a lot of surfers. They go on comparison sites. They probably do make poor decisions because they've gone on them, not really thought about actually how long to fix for, because they've not sought advice. Whereas a lot of people are scared to pick up the phone to a broker. They feel like they're going to be backed up into a corner. They may not be able to rapport with them, barriers in the way, feel like they're going to be sold to. So ultimately, this opens that door softly to them to then open them avenue with them customers that you may not get inquire in the first place, because they just want to get some indicative ideas initially.
And you can also tell them, look, working with a broker is not about just getting your mortgage deal across the line. It's all the other. You're utilizing our 20, I don't know how long you guys have been in the game, Jamie. I think you're only born maybe about 20 years ago, but you can utilize our 30 plus 20 whatever years in the game of how many thousands of transactions that we've been party to, what we've seen, and all these other things along the way, rather than going it alone and doing it yourself. And who'd want to deal with lenders directly in this current environment?
Especially certain lenders
who shall remain nameless. I think that's a great place for us to pack up episode 20. We have made it to episode 20. And just to, before we started, guys, we were sharing some information with Lewis and Jamie with regards to where we are. We are currently at 1,326 all-time downloads of the Broker Collective podcast, which, considering when we started this journey of ours and how it started and to where we are at the moment, I think is something that we should be proud of. Our reach isn't just in the UK. Obviously, there's brokers around the country that seem to be listening in on a regular basis, all the way from the States to Far East Asia. So if you do have any comments or you do have any feedback on the show of things that you'd like to see or not see, then please drop Lewis Shaw a line. You can find him, Lewis Shaw, on LinkedIn, and he will be happy to receive your feedback. Join us on our next episode, where we will see if the world has imploded as a result of Rachel Reeves's budget, or if things have calmed down and we will by then know whether the Bank of England will have cut the base rate by another 25 bips or whether they decided to keep it in. There's a lot to look forward to in the next episode of the No Award Winning Broker Collective. Thank you for your time. See you soon. Take care.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.